of friends, it'd be great if you can leave that open, because that's where we're going to be looking. If you ask my wife about this week and my preparation for this sermon, she will tell you that I have struggled with this one all week. Every now and then you get a sermon that you struggle with. This is it. So let me pray, because I'm going to need it. Father, we thank you. We thank you for your word. Even when we struggle with it, Lord, even when it can seem clear and obvious, and Lord, especially when we then see it applied to our lives. So Father, as we move through this passage this week, today, Lord, speak. May your Spirit move in our hearts, in our minds, in our very beings. Illuminate, bring to light that which needs to be brought to light. Comfort those parts of us that need to be comforted. And this we ask in Jesus' precious name. Amen. Well, as I said, I've sort of struggled with this passage all week. I wonder if you've actually noticed how tricky it's been to preach through the book of Job, or just how tricky Job can be. I don't know. How have you been finding it, Rob? Easy, yes. Oh, the voice of youth. It's a tricky book. It's tricky. It's got parts in it that are quite obvious. It's got parts in it which are a little bit hard to understand, because it is actually quite poetic. And so that even makes it difficult too. It brings its own sort of interesting aspect to it. And I was aware after last Sunday, I spoke to about four different people on different topics to do with the preaching on Job, and it became really clear to me that not only is it a difficult book to preach on, but you can actually come at Job from different angles, as it were, or with a different hat on, maybe is a better way of thinking it. For instance, you can put your theological hat on, your hat that you put on when you go to Bible college and you have to work through a book, and look, that makes Job very interesting. It's hard work. There are parts of the book of Job that, you know, seem paradoxical. There are parts that are really clear, and there are parts that the scholars are divided on. But that's actually what scholars do all the time. That's what's in their job description: disagree with somebody else. And so if you come at Job with your theological hat on, you come with a particular sort of emphasis. I was aware that I've actually come to the book of Job in this sermon series with my pastoral hat on. So what that means is I haven't got rid of my theological hat, but you do the theology, you work through the passages, you understand what's going on here, but always in the back of my head is, so what does this mean for me? And what does this mean for those who are listening to this book being preached? In fact, what does it mean to live the book of Job? What does it mean to live the book of Job? And that's actually been very obvious to me in the last couple of sermons we've had. You don't often get to see this, but each of the sermons has a title. Rob put this series together, and the last four sermons have had had very similar titles. For instance, 4 weeks ago we looked at suffering and despair. 3 weeks ago we looked at suffering and sin. Last week we looked at suffering and sovereignty. Can you see a theme developing here? And this week we're looking at suffering and waiting. And you can look at those theologically, but you can look at them pastorally too. And when I put my pastoral hat on, each of those topics has dealt with a particular question. For instance, suffering and despair. Is it okay to feel crushed and to just cry out and be real? That's what we looked at. Suffering and sin. The question was, did I do something to deserve this? Suffering and sovereignty, last week. The question was, if God is so powerful and sovereign, i.e. king, why doesn't he step in and stop the suffering? And this week, it's suffering and waiting. And for me, the question here is, what do I do in the midst of the suffering? What do I do when I'm in the valley of the shadow of death, or whatever analogy you want to use? Today we're going to look at the idea of the waiting, as it were. And also wisdom. And it comes from this really interesting passage, chapter 28 of the book of Job. 28 is like this, I heard one preacher call it like an island. It's just different to everything else around it. For instance, up until now, Job has suffered, and then we've had chapters and chapters and chapters of Job's three friends saying something and Job refuting it. And that's been going backwards and forwards like a ping pong match for a number of chapters. And then you're about to get to a character called Elihu, and then God's going to speak. But we don't know that. Job doesn't know that's about to happen yet. But you get chapter 28, which is a chapter that talks about wisdom. Have a look with me, verse 12 of chapter 28. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. And the sea says, it's not with me. Job is in the midst of his suffering. And in the middle of that suffering, he asks, as it were, where can wisdom be found? And actually more than that, not only where can wisdom be found, but can it be acquired? Who has it? Well, those questions are answered in the following verses. Have a look, verse 13. Man does not comprehend its worth, that is, wisdom's worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The land of the living is an interesting sort of phrase. Wisdom can't be found in the land of the living. It's very similar and the same sort of idea as from the book of Ecclesiastes, where you hear the phrase all the time, under the sun. If you're very familiar with the book of Ecclesiastes, you know that phrase, under the sun, under the sun. This is land of the living. Where can wisdom be found? Can it be found in this world? No. Or to use the phrase of Ecclesiastes, can it be found under the sun? No. It doesn't appear to be able to be found. And even the most inaccessible places, for instance, here in verse 14, the deep and the sea, those places where, you know, we look around, we can't see it. Maybe it's in those places we can't see. And they cry out, it's not with us either. I'm amazed when I consider, you know, even we can't get to those inaccessible places, even with our modern technology. And they too cry out, wisdom is not with us. It can't be found here. Then in verses 15 and following, we see that not only is wisdom not able to be found, but it can't even be purchased. I won't read all of it, but have a look at verse 15. Wisdom cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. Or jump to verse 17. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for the jewels of gold. Or verse 19. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Wisdom cannot be purchased. Money can actually buy you a lot of things, can't it? Money can purchase a lot. We often say money can't buy you happiness. Or as the Beatles said, money can't buy you love. Money can't buy wisdom either. Even the greatest jewels cannot purchase wisdom. In fact, wisdom is elusive. I love that word, elusive. It's elusive. You think you've got it and it just slips away, or it wasn't there to start with. And it's especially seen in these opening verses to chapter 28. I wonder if when you were hearing them read, these opening verses, whether you were thinking, what on earth is all that about? This mining, ends of darkness, the farthest recesses, the blackest darkness, shafts, places where people dangle and sway and all this. It's basically saying that we can mine in the most incredible parts of the world and find the most precious, precious jewels and metals. And think about it. We can, can't we? Even in ancient times, they were able to mine some of the most difficult to get to places for gold and for precious stones. And yet, we can't find wisdom. We can't find it. We can't can't get it. But there is one who does have it. And we'll get to him in a second. So what is it that wisdom is? What are we talking about? Well, there's a whole sermon series in one. What is wisdom? And I don't even know if I'm going to do justice to it. But just, I want to, in the context of this passage, I want to understand wisdom to be basically understanding. Understanding from beginning to end, as it were. Let me explain where I get that from. In Job chapter 12, if you want to follow, you can. Leave your finger in Job 28 because we're coming back. Job chapter 12, verse 13. It says this: to God belong wisdom and power. Counsel and understanding are His. Tied up with this idea of wisdom is counsel and understanding. And you see it in chapter 28 as well. Have a look at chapter 28, verse 24. Actually, we'll go back to verse 23. God understands the way to wisdom, and He alone knows where it dwells, for He views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. God is the one who has all knowledge and all understanding. God is the one who has seen the past and the present and the future. All understanding, all knowledge, all wisdom is His. For us, we look, but we can't find it. Again, if you're to borrow a phrase from the book of Ecclesiastes, God puts the desire for eternity into our hearts, but we cannot fathom it from beginning to end. In the middle of Job's suffering, he's looking for understanding, for wisdom, and it's even more elusive. Can anyone understand it? Does anyone have it? And the answer is, of course, yes. As we saw in verse 23, God understands the way to wisdom, and He alone knows where it dwells. God alone knows the past, the present, the future. He has all understanding. He knows what He is talking about. And in the following verses, you see that even not only does God have all understanding, but all that He does is wise. Verse 25 and following. When God established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when He made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then He looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. Wisdom is part of God's creation, and all that God does is wise. If you're to try and sum up, all understanding is God's, and all that God does is wise. That's as simple as I can put it. So I'm going to put my pastoral hat on now. What does that mean for Job? If all understanding, all wisdom is God's, and everything He does is wise, what does that mean for Job? You see, here is Job, remember, in the midst of his suffering, looking for wisdom and for understanding. I'm very much aware of, say, Romans 8, that very well-known passage. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. You know that passage. You've heard that passage before, haven't you? It's a very famous passage, also a very misunderstood passage. It doesn't say that everything that happens is good. The death of Job's children is not good. What monster could possibly ever say that? But all things God will bring good from. How? Don't know. See, that's where wisdom resides with Him. And this is Job in the midst of it, struggling with it. Everything that happens is not necessarily good, but all of God's good purposes will come about. So God, who is wise, will act wisely, and Job, in the middle of his suffering, is waiting and waiting and waiting. it's not a passive wait. We're not told to wait passively, as it were. Have a look with me at the very last verse. "And he said to man," this is God speaking, "the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding." So what you have here is you have God, where all wisdom resides and everything he does is wise, but also we are called to be wise. And the beginning of our wisdom is to fear the Lord, that is, to trust the Lord and to trust in his wisdom and all that he does, being wise. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. It's a phrase, it's an idea that you see all the way through the wisdom literature. For those of you who are not sure, the book of Ecclesiastes, the Psalms, the book of Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Job are wisdom literature. And wisdom is found in trusting the Lord. It's not a passive wait. It's a wait in which Job continues to trust God. Does he struggle? Yes, he does. Just read the next couple of chapters. Just read the next couple of chapters and see how he struggles with that. But he continues. It's the same for us. In the midst of our suffering, in the midst of whatever is our turmoil, in the midst of whatever is our valley of the shadow of death, when it seems unfair, when we don't understand, we wait. We wait for the God who acts wisely. For in him all wisdom is found. You can't miss what's happened this week. You've only got to read a paper, listen to the radio, watch TV, or looked at the web pages. With the death of Nelson Mandela. I'm not sure where Mandela stood with the Lord. That's something you guys can talk about over morning tea. But I am sure that God brought about his good purposes for that nation through that man. I wonder if it was obvious. I wonder if anyone was wise enough to see in 1962-63 when Mandela was arrested and thrown into prison. And I wonder if it was obvious in 1972 when he was still there. And I wonder if it was obvious in 1982 when he was still there. And I wonder if it was obvious even in 1990 when after 27 years he was finally released. That prison term was part of who Mandela was. And it changed the nation. Or consider the 400 years of silence. 400 years of silence. You see, the people of God had heard from their prophets. Isaiah and Ezekiel and all the great prophets had spoken about this Messiah that was coming, and then for 400 years, nothing happened. The prophecies dried up, as it were. And zealots rose up and they fought against, and they tried to bring back the kingdom of God with power, and it just never came to fruition. And for 400 years, I wonder if it was obvious after the first 100 years, or the second 100 years, or the third lot of 100 years, or the fourth lot of 100 years, that God in his wisdom was acting. And one night, a child is born. One night, in God's perfect timing and in his perfect wisdom, as his people waited, Christ came. As we move towards Christmas, we don't always understand all that God does, do we? And yet we know that wisdom resides with the Lord, and all that he does is wise. That's all I've got to trust in. Who could have possibly thought that an itinerant preacher born in a little town in the back of nowhere with a ragtag bunch of people who fought and squabbled and never got it really to start with, they got it eventually, who could think that a guy who went around healing people at one time and then upsetting all the local authorities the next time, who would have thought then when he died on a cross that that was God's wisdom? Until 3 days later, when it was made obvious. God is wise, and all that he does is wise, and we don't passively wait, but we passively trust in that wisdom. Trusting in a God who is wise and will act wisely. Let me pray. Father, sometimes in the midst of our turmoils, in the midst of that chronic illness, in the midst of those unmet desires, in the midst of grief, in the midst of children who have gone, in the midst of dashed hopes, it's just hard, Lord. And we struggle and we cry out. But we cry out to you, Lord. You see the beginning, you see the end, and everything in between. And you are a God in which wisdom resides, and you are a God who acts wisely. Give us what we need, Lord, to persevere in that, to trust you, the God who acts, and who acts wisely. And Lord, this we ask.